The Neo Tiger pissing match continued in the two papers and on several of the school's internal news groups for the next month. The duelists, for the most part, were content to sit back and let popular opinion duke it out for them. Enough defenses of Sergei the Tiger were coming from unaffiliated students and even faculty members that none of them had to lift a finger. As for Serge himself, he didn't care one way or another. He had important things to do, like play in the snow with his mistress and her friends, and sleep in front of the fire in the castle library, and mooch snacks from visitors. To thumb their noses at Clarissa, the impromptu IBGF/IDS intramural ice hockey squad immediately adopted him as their mascot, then rampaged through February, at one point defeating the school's official team. Not that this was really much of an achievement, though Utanetenjo's hat trick was fairly dramatic even given the weak opposition. Unfortunately for Corwin Ravenhair, he missed that game. It happened on a Friday afternoon, when he would have been in class at Fritz Koopman Memorial High in New Avalon anyway. But even had it been held that evening, when by tradition he would have been there, he'd have missed it this weekend. At 1:05 p.m., Friday, February 24th, 2406, Corwin was in Mr. Fujisawa's standard class, doodling in his notebook and thinking about food. Not that he was particularly hungry, but on Friday nights he went to Gerardo, and he and Utena went out to eat someplace in the Bajor system. Well, except for the previous one. That had been surreal, eating their celebratory post-word-binding meal at Ping's Garden in Worcester, but Aunt Belle had been so serene about the whole thing, and there'd been a mirror there if they really needed it. So anyway, he was thinking of different genres of food and what he might suggest during the usual semi-democratic decision phase. Did he feel like going up to the Marché Mövenpick on B5? Or one of the other restaurants on the Zocalo? Or perhaps somewhere on Bajor itself? Utena hadn't cared much for the first traditional Bajoran restaurant they'd tried back in October, but Corwin had his suspicions about just how authentic the place had been. And if he could convince her to give the experiment another go, why then...
Corwin Ravenhair, please report to the office. Corwin Ravenhair, to the office, please.
Corwin blinked, looking up at the intercom speaker with a look of consternation that was half for his interrupted train of thought and half puzzlement over his summoning. "Uh-oh, Ravenhair," said Fujisawa, grinning. "What did you do now?" Corwin shrugged, genuinely baffled. "Nothing, as far as I know." "Well, you'd better go see what they want," the teacher observed, angling a thumb at the door. "We'll try not to do anything really exciting until you get back." Corwin left his books and such. The period was only about half over. Surely he'd be back in plenty of time. And with a shrug to the querying look of Tenchi Shannon, who sat next to him, he left the room and made his way toward the office. He was exceedingly surprised by the sight that met him there. He thought he'd seen Gudrun Trumace, heavy weapons specialist of the Valkyrie, in Midgard civvies maybe twice in his life. But here she was, all 6'4" of her, her long, wavy chestnut hair looking like it had been polished, her rangy, well-appointed frame draped in a nice but not ostentatious Armani. She was at her ease, as Gudrun always was, chatting with Principal Strickland and Mrs. Bonus, the school's well-loved secretary.
"Ah, there you are, Corwin, dear," said this institutional fixture with a warm, don't-worry-nobody-died smile.
"Hi, Mrs. B," said Corwin, getting his good cheer quotient in before Mr. Strickland spoke and made it inappropriate. "Mr. Ravenhair," said Strickland, a bald-headed, humorless-looking man whose face, though a bit severe, didn't show the bulk of the frustration and stress of being principal at a school which contained Corwin and his Ragnarok contemporaries, and would someday contain the Morgan twins and Sylvie Daniels, brought with it. "So good of you to join us." Corwin didn't take offense or look guiltily around. Half a year at Koopman High had taught him that Mr. Strickland always greeted those summoned to his office that way, even if they hadn't kept him waiting. "Mr. Strickland," he replied, nodding. "Gudrun, is there something wrong?"
"Your aunt,"
said Strickland in a tone that combined a high degree of dubiousness about the relationship and unamusement with the situation, "is here to take you away from us, Mr. Ravenhair, possibly for the rest of the year." Corwin blinked. "The rest of the year?" he blurted, then realized what it must be about and gave his fellow Valkyrie a very surprised look. Gudrun nodded. "You may be able to return before then," she said formally, "but your grandfather felt it necessary to allow for every eventuality. He has discussed the matter by telephone with Mr. Strickland."
"At considerable length," said Strickland.
"It's not my policy to interfere in the family business of my students, so long as they don't ask me to and it doesn't affect their work," the principal went on pointedly. "In this case, though, my natural instinct would be to get involved. But your grandfather has persuaded me otherwise. So." Strickland reached down to Mrs. Bonus's out tray, picked up a file folder, and handed it to Corwin. "You'll take with you a list of the required reading for the rest of the year. In May, your final examinations will be sent to your home here in New Avalon. You'll have a week to complete and return them. We'll be going on the honor system with this, Ravenhair, so if you pull any funny stuff, chances are you're the only one who'll ever know." "It's not my policy to do that, either," said the principal with just the faintest hint of a smile. "But in your case, I'll make an exception." Corwin nodded. "Thank you, Mr. Strickland," he said. "I won't let you down." Strickland narrowed his eyes into that drill instructor glare he had, leaned forward, jutted out his chin, deliberately parodying himself, Corwin realized with a thrill of amusement. Strickland, like many bulldogs, wasn't such a bad guy once you got to where you could read him, and growled, "See that you don't, mister!" "I take it," said Corwin as he and Gudrun left the office, "that it's time." "Yep," the Valkyrie replied. "Your grandfather wants you in his office at 3 sharp. Corwin sighed. Gudrun clapped him on the shoulder. "Cheer up," she said. "You're as ready as anybody's ever been. You'll make it. We're all behind you." "All but one," said Corwin glumly. Gudrun grinned, her reddish-brown eyes twinkling. "You might be surprised." Corwin didn't respond. Didn't really even hear her. He was already running through the list of things he had to do this afternoon. At 3 p.m. sharp, wearing the dress uniform of the Valkyrier, he stood before the desk of Odin Winterbeard, ruler of Asgard, and, incidentally, his maternal grandfather. Odin regarded the young man gravely and contemplatively for a moment, then said, "Corwin Ravenhair, son of Skuld Ravenhair, the Aesir Council has set the time for your trial of ascension to begin. You will report to the Council Chamber in 8 days' time and receive your assignment. Have you selected your companion for the trial?" Corwin hesitated for perhaps half a second, then nodded and replied, "Allfather, I have." "Name your companion," said Odin. "Allfather, I have chosen Nall Silverclaw, White Dragon of Alfheim, to be my companion." Odin nodded. "So be it. He will be notified." This was a matter of form, of course. Nall had been planned as Corwin's trial companion since the one's birth and the other's hatching. As for notifying him, well, he was right outside, waiting for Corwin to get through here before reporting to Alfheim for his own appearance before the Dragon King. "Have you chosen the one who will be your companion through your week of preparation?" Odin went on. Corwin frowned thoughtfully. This one was trickier. The standard answer wouldn't do. And he was trying to think of a way to phrase it that wouldn't break the form of the occasion. Odin noted his hesitation this time and said, "Speak, if there be complications." Relieved, Corwin replied, "Allfather, there are. I had expected that you would summon me for this purpose in the summer, after the closing of Midgard's schools. I would have my word sister, Utnatenjo, with whom you are acquainted, to be my preparation companion, but she has final examinations next week." Odin pursed his lips thoughtfully for a moment, then nodded.
"We'll see about that," he said. "Fear not. Return to Midgard now. Make what notifications you feel are necessary, and collect your companion. Your time of seclusion and preparation begins at tomorrow's nightfall."
Corwin wanted to ask exactly how Odin planned to pull off getting Utina excused from finals, but it wasn't his place to ask, not under these conditions. Instead, he merely bowed and said, "Thank you, Allfather." Odin glanced up at his grandson, his one eye twinkling.
"Don't thank me yet, boy," he said,
not unkindly. As soon as Corwin emerged from the office, Nall winged over from the window ledge where he'd waited, settling on the young demigod's shoulder. "So?" he asked. "Did you change your mind?" Corwin sighed. "No, Nall, I didn't," he replied. "We've been over this and over this. You knew I wasn't going to." Nall frowned a little cat frown, shaking his head. "It's a mistake, I'm telling you," he said. "I know we planned to go together a long time ago, but that was before she came along." "I told you I am not dragging Utina off on my trial," said Corwin grumpily. "You know how rough these things are. They're going to send me to slay a wyvern in the Tyndalos Peaks or some damn thing. It's hard going, the conditions are lousy, and the tasks themselves are always really dangerous. People get killed." "Oh, sure, but you'll take me along, no problem." "You're facing your own trial," Corwin told him. "You'd have to do something dangerous and difficult anyway. Utin has paid her dues. She doesn't need to be dragged off on somebody else's damn fool crusade." "She'd love it," Nall told him. "You know she would. She thrives on heroic challenges. And she'd be helping you get what you want most. You know what that sort of thing means to her."
"No, Nall," said Corwin. "Now drop it, will you? It's already done. I've already named you my companion. What am I supposed to do, go back into Grandad's office and say, 'No, wait, strike that, reverse it'?"
"Let it go. As soon as we're back from Jotunheim or wherever, Utrina and I will have plenty of opportunity for adventure hunting for Anthe." Nall chuckled. "You sound like you already know her," he said. "After everything Utrin has told me about her, I almost feel like I do," Corwin replied. "Now look, you'd better get off to Alfheim. You don't want to be late. You know how your uncle gets when people keep him waiting." "Well, okay, but I still think it's a mistake. But, like you said, it's done now. We're committed. I just hope you don't have cause to regret it once we're wherever we're going." He shrugged, as much as an animal shaped like a cat can shrug. "See you in a week, Rocket Boy." Corwin grinned and scruffled the dragon. "In a week, Furball." As soon as he arrived on Jurado, 2 hours later, Corwin recognized his grandfather's handiwork and understood how the Allfather intended to free his friend from her mortal obligations to aid him with his celestial ones. When the one-hit wonder touched down at Port Jaradar spaceport, it was snowing hard and had been for about an hour. When he arrived at the castle, Utina had just come from the shower, after participating in the Castle Tiger's summary execution of the Mandeville Griffins, so named not for Caitlin's father, but for the mythical animal, which was reputed to be the invention of the possibly equally mythical Sir John Mandeville. She was in sweats and an Art of Noise t-shirt, scrubbing at her hair with a towel, when she entered Castle 501 and saw Corwin standing there, his hands in Caitlin's, a pleased, worried look on the brown-haired girl's face. "Hey, Corwin," said Utina, pleased to see him. "You're early." She noted Kate's look and asked, "What's the matter?"
"It's time," said Corwin simply. "My trial begins a week from tomorrow."
Utina blinked. "Already? I thought they told you 6 to 8 months.
"It's been six, Caitlin pointed out.
After a little mental math, she said, "Huh, I guess it has. I'd just gotten used to the idea of it being this summer." She looked downcast. "This is going to be a little complicated. I promised I'd spend the prep time with you, and I will, but, well, it's going to take a lot of fast talking to my profs." She went to her wardrobe and opened it. "Guess I'd better put my uniform back on," she said over her shoulder. "Bugging teachers for favors always works better if you're properly dressed."
"That won't be necessary," said Corwin, gesturing to the window. "See that snow? Unless I miss my guess, that's Granddad's doing, and it's not going to stop for days. By Monday, this place will be paralyzed. Teachers won't be able to get in here from town. Even crossing the campus will be a challenge. There won't be any finals next week."
Utrina turned to look at him, amazed. "The All-Father's going to disrupt this whole school? Hell, this whole community? So that I can help you prep for your trial without screwing up my schoolwork?"
Corwin grinned. "Looks that way. When he asked me who I wanted, and I told him I'd had you in mind, but you'd be unavailable, he said, 'We'll see about that,' and didn't ask me for a second choice."
Kate tutted with mock disapproval.
Nepotism, she said.
She climbed up on her bed to pick up where she'd left off studying. Serge rolled in under her left arm, grumbling contentedly as he snuggled in for the long haul.
Utrina absorbed that for a moment, then grinned. "Well then," she said, "I guess I'd better pack for a week."
The duelists studied that weekend anyway, just in case. But as the snow outside got deeper and deeper and showed no signs of slackening, it looked more and more likely that Corwin's prediction was right. On Monday, the administration canceled finals for that day only, stressing that the snowfall was expected to break that night, and by morning everything was expected to be up and running again. It did stop that night, briefly, leading Azalin to be dejected and start studying for her Tuesday morning statistics final again. But then, around 2 a.m, it started again more fierce than before, and that morning President Tiefeld announced, on the campus radio station, a schedule realignment. "Final examinations for Term C-2406 are postponed until after CD term break. They will commence on Monday, March 20th. His thin voice announced from the speaker of the radio set in the castle library. Caitlin hushed the round of cheers which followed so that she could hear the rest. "To compensate for this alteration in the schedule, Term D's scheduled events will all be moved forward 1 week. This includes extracurricular activities such as the Spring Symphony Concert, Spring Formal, and the Class of 2406's commencement exercise, but not interscholastic activities, which would have to be rescheduled with the other schools involved. Sporting events for the week of March 20th will be canceled or rescheduled as other schools' cooperation will allow."
Tiefeld cleared his throat and went on, "The administration apologizes for any inconvenience this may cause, and for making you come back from break to be greeted by final exams, then plunge straight into D-term from C-term's finals. In the final analysis, we felt this would be less disruptive than rescheduling CD break, and a good deal more popular than shortening it," he added with that dryly humorous tone he had, guaranteed to get a laugh at assemblies and commencements.
"In the meantime," Tiefeld continued after allowing time for his audience to laugh, "every effort will be made to keep the school's infrastructure and services functioning. We may be stuck on campus, but we aren't going to starve. And the infirmary will remain open should anyone need it. For the time being, it doesn't look like any of us is going anywhere. So bundle up warmly and enjoy your semi-vacation," he advised. "This is President Tiefeld, signing off."
Belana Torres clicked off the radio and said, "All right!" Despite the somewhat ominous thought of heading straight into D-term from C-term's finals, the others seemed eager to echo that sentiment. Early that evening, as it got dark outside and the snow still fell, Caitlin and Kyuichi Sayonji were taking advantage of the unexpected freedom from finals to get in some extra training time.
As usual, they said little as they worked. Kate's vocal range as sensei, apart from Kiai, was generally limited to clipped, barked commands, Sionji's as student to acknowledgments, and the occasional grunt of pain as he slipped up and got thwacked by the wooden sheath of Kate's zatoichi. Today they were using the main dueling floor, instead of one of the smaller practice rooms on the second floor. Sionji's tachi hung on a peg near the rack of towels and the first aid kit. Sergei the Tiger was camped out under the little table with the water jug on it, yawning. It was his policy to nap through Kate and Sionji's practice session so as to conserve his strength until bedtime. Today, though, something very peculiar happened, something which got Serge's full attention. Sionji was in the middle of an intermediate kata when he suddenly stopped, reeling as if struck, his bokuto continuing on in his former direction of travel without him, to clatter noisily across the stone of the dueling floor. Caitlin's first instinct was to correct him, but she realized almost instantly that such a massive departure from the kata could not be a simple lapse of form. She advanced toward him, her teacher persona dropping away like a slipped-off coat, and asked, "Kyuichi? Are you okay?" "Stay back," said Sionji, raising a hand. "I know this feeling." Suddenly, with a sizzling noise, a pattern appeared on the stone beneath Sionji's feet. A six-pointed star of black, crackling lightning, appearing first as points surrounding him and then growing from those points to create the full pattern, with Sionji squarely in the middle of the central hexagon. Caitlin recoiled, startled. Serge got to his feet, ran to his mistress's side, and roared, fairly impressively, for all that he wasn't nearly mature yet. But Sionji, standing in the middle of this pattern, was it Kate's imagination or was he starting to fade? Didn't look panicked or even all that upset. In fact, as he looked down at the circle, he smiled, slowly and slyly, the smile of a man who knows what is about to happen and sees a way to turn it to his advantage. "Don't worry," he called to Kate over the escalating noise of the sizzling, racing energy. "I've done this before. Last time it was someone else summoning me, but it feels essentially the same." "What?" Kate began, then stopped as it hit her. "You're going back?" she cried. "Back to Sephiro?" Sionji, now definitely fading, nodded. "It's all right," he yelled, his voice sounding very hollow and distant now. "I've got a surprise or two for them this time." Not knowing what else to do, Kate held up her zatoichi. "Take it!" she cried, and threw it into the circle, not knowing if he would be able to catch it. Catch it he did, with a wild grin on his face as the wind racing clockwise around the circle blew his hair out of its usual working ponytail, and just before he flickered out of existence he threw her a wink. The circle collapsed with a noise like a slamming door, and the dueling floor was still. Serge, not liking this turn of events at all, roared again, then pawed disconsolately at his stunned mistress's hakama leg. She reached absently down and patted his head. "How," she thought to herself, "am I going to explain this to Wakaba?" Just like last time, Sionji had a sensation of falling, the world smearing away into meaningless colors and lights. The first time it had happened, he had been mad, and had taken it for further delirium, in whatever capacity he'd noticed it at all. This time he knew exactly what it was, and he had a very strong suspicion of what awaited him at the other side. He righted Caitlin's hidden blade in his hands, clutched it tight like an anchor, and waited. With a whoosh and a thump, he was back on solid ground, kneeling on what felt like a rug, head bowed, eyes closed. Without even opening his eyes, he could feel the difference. He wondered if it were because the place was so familiar to him that he could feel its size and the height of its ceiling from the acoustics and the air pressure, or if this newly noticed sensitivity were a result of his training with Caitlin. Either way, it served him well, for he had time to compose himself before opening his eyes, looking up, and having his suspicion completely and awfully confirmed. He was kneeling in the exact center of a huge round room with a domed ceiling and arched windows. Around him were a few pieces of furniture, a couple of white leather couches with people lounging on them, and glass and chrome coffee tables with nothing on them. But mostly the room was empty. As empty as its owner's heart. And standing a few paces away from Sayanji, smiling a very self-satisfied smile, was that owner. Sayanji got to his feet, fixing the black-armored man he faced with wild, wide violet eyes, and raked his disordered green hair out of his face with one hand while he clutched the deep-stained wooden length of Kotetsu no Sasiaki with the other.
"Otori," he snarled. "You dare!"
Then he stopped, as if struck by a conflicting train of thought, and turned this way, then that, in place, raking the room with his wild pinpoint gaze. Some of the figures on the couches he recognized. There was Toga, the smug bastard, grinning that smug bastard grin of his, and beside him, what's-her-name? That raspberry-haired girl Arisugawa had been so hung up on back in the day. She had the blank look of one who has very recently been shown the end of the world, but Toga was the same as ever, clear-eyed and faintly sardonic. Sayanji suppressed an urge to leap upon him and shatter his skull. Plenty of time for that later. Right now he had a different kind of impression to make. He didn't know the others. A big blonde man with the same mind-scrubbed look as the girl, a prematurely white-haired woman wearing insufficient clothing for the time of year, and skipped over them as though he hadn't noticed them, returning his crazed gaze to Akio. Where had the deputy chairman gotten the get-up he was wearing now? Black robes, spiky armor? It hit Sayanji like an icicle in the chest. The man was dressed like the high priest in Tenchu. What was his name? Sayanji had never been a very spiritual man, and now the name of the priest escaped him. A Z-word, he thought. No matter. There was a performance to be given. He had only to gather the data now. He could comb through it later at his leisure. Now he lunged forward, breath hissing between his teeth.
"Where is she?" he snarled. "You bastard, what have you done with her? If you've harmed her, by God, I'll kill you! Kill you!"
So saying, Sayanji closed the distance to Akio and, rather pathetically, whacked him on the breastplate with the sheathed end of Kotetsu no Sasiaki. Akio gave him a rather pitying look, reached up, and casually pushed the wooden length aside. "Really, Kyoichi, a stick," he said dryly. "You might at least thank me. From the look of you, you've been wandering the wastelands for some time." Sayanji smiled internally. Another stroke of luck. The throw of the dice had put him, for today's unplanned training session, in the dirtiest, rattiest of his geese, the one he'd been meaning to clean and mend but hadn't gotten around to yet. Combined with the look on his face and the disarray the summoning itself had put his hair in, he had no doubt that he did look like a wild man who had been wandering the world, rather than a kenjutsu student who happened to have been yanked out of the dojo. And of course, Akio didn't recognize the Zatoichi for what it was. There were no such things in Sephiro. Who would need to hide a sword? In some parts of the world, there were more common parts of people's wardrobes than shoes. Advantage, Sayanji.
"Thank you," he snarled. "After all you've done for me, where is she?"
Akio chuckled indulgently.
"I've missed you, Kyoichi," he said.
"Calm yourself. She's here and quite safe. In a moment, I'll take you to see her." Then his face hardened. "In the meantime, you might show me some respect. You address the high priest of this land now, not just the deputy chairman of the academy you walked away from." Sayanji looked like he might retort, then subsided grudgingly, lowering the Zatoichi. "Sorry," he said, with some semblance of his old civility. "I was disoriented." Then he raised eyes shining with hope to the new and, Sionji had no inward doubt, usurper priest, and said, "Is she really here?" Akio smiled thinly. "She is," he replied, "and I'm sure she'll be very pleased to see you. She needs her friends around her now, poor thing," he added mockingly. "Toga, get Sionji something to drink, will you? Then I'll take him up to..."
"No,"
Sionji snapped. "I don't want a drink. I just want to see her. That's all I need." Akio gave him an appraising look, then that same smile again. The sort of smile a person might give a particularly stupid cat, who consistently and comically mistakes the glass patio door for an opening and bumps noisily into it. "She'll be gratified by your loyalty, I'm sure," he said. "But she's resting right now. Why don't you go with Toga and get something to eat? He'll show you somewhere where you can get some sleep, and I'll take you to Anthe in the morning." In the morning. Sionji paced away from Akio, looking out the nearest window at the starry night sky, the familiar old stars of Sephiro, which now looked positively alien after the night sky over Jurado. He had seen not one, but several alien skies. He had known the true friendship of the Rose Knight, and the love of one he had once abused, while Akio stayed here in his little tower and wove his little plans. He turned back. "All right," he said. Akio smiled. "I knew you'd see reason," he said sardonically. "Toga, take Sionji to his old room and see that he has something to eat." Toga rose, bowed, and said, "Of course, Lord Akio. Good to see you again, Kyuichi," he added, smiling that old, smooth, who's-your-only-friend-then smile. Sionji concentrated hard on not showing Toga how much he hated him as the two of them left the tower. "Disappeared?" Wakaba Shinohara blurted. Kate nodded.
"Right in front of me. All I could do was throw him my sword. He said he thought he knew the feeling. Thought he knew where he was going.
Miki Kaworu stopped his watch, then regarded her gravely. "Sephiro," he said flatly. Kate nodded.
"He thought so."
She looked thoughtful for a moment, then went on.
"He didn't seem too worried about it."
"What could have happened?" wondered Wakaba. "Say, wasn't he the first one Utena brought over? You don't suppose it wears off? Maybe Miki will disappear too in a couple of days." Kate shook her head.
"I don't think so. He said..." "How did he word it? Last time it was someone else summoning me. But it feels essentially this same. He thought he knew who was doing it."
Juri took a sip of tea, put her cup back down on its saucer, and said without doubt in her voice, "The deputy chairman." "You think he has that kind of power?" Wakaba asked, sounding dubious.
"He has power enough that the master mage fears him," Juri pointed out. "You reported that yourself."
True, Wakaba mused. "But if he could do that, why hasn't he grabbed all of us? Why doesn't he just haul Utena back and finish having it out with her?"
Miki shook his head. "I don't think he can do that," he said. "Utena is different from the rest of us. Whether Chairman Otori wishes to admit it or not, she won the Rose Tournament. I expect that places her beyond his reach. And you're the apprentice to the Master Mage. You came here through a dimensional doorway cast by Clef. As for Miss Jury and me, we spurned him the last time he tried to recruit us, and all he could do was erase our memories of the encounter. Imperfectly, as it turns out, because we've both recovered them now. So did Sayanji. Yes, but then he put his rose seal back on and went looking for Miss Himemiya anyway. For his own reasons, not Akio's, Jury concurred, but it may have been enough to set him apart.
And now he's back there, and Akio has him? Wakaba cried. Damn it, this is awful! We have to do something!
Like what? Asked Jury. We have no way of crossing back. You and Tenjo have both tried to send us. Apparently the powers she's inherited, and you've gained from the Master Mage, don't work that way. Wakaba slammed her fist down on the table.
Damn it! She repeated, louder this time. I can't just leave him there!
I share your concern, Jury said, her aspect softening a bit. Honestly, I do. But I don't think we have any choice in the matter.
There's one thing going for us, Kate noted. Corwin.
Huh? Said Wakaba. Then she blinked.
Of course. He's taking his test thing for godhood. Once he's done with that, sure, he'll be able to help us get back there to look for Sayanji.
Well, that's the theory, anyway, said Kate. He and Utena already plan to go back and find Anthe.
Wakaba hit the table again, this time triumphantly. Well, there we go, then!
Then her face fell as a realization struck her.
How long is this trial thing supposed to take?
You never know until the task is assigned, Kate admitted sadly.
And that won't be until Saturday.
Wakaba slumped.
Damn, who knows what might happen?
She folded her arms on the table in front of her and dropped her head onto them.
This can't be happening. Just when everything was going so well, she moaned.
The situation may not be as dire as we think, Miki pointed out. Sayanji certainly didn't seem to think so.
Sayanji's an idiot, said Wakaba, with, undoubtedly, some mild hysterical exaggeration. He thinks he can handle anything after everything he went through before and came back from.
Maybe he's right, said Jury. That which does not kill one, and all that. I know I'm stronger than I was when last I faced Akio's powers of persuasion, and I resisted him with partial success then. I think I could stand up to him now.
Miki nodded.
And I. Now that we all know what he really is and what he's really capable of, I think his power over any of us would be extremely limited. He smiled. Besides, Sayanji's crafty. He probably started forming a plan as soon as he realized what was happening to him. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he has the situation fully under control right now.